Welcome to Cool Climate Living. My name is Monica Morse, and today's program is the first of what we hope will be an interesting and exciting year of stories by and about people from the Bathurst region. Susan and I look forward to sharing their interviews. Today I'm talking to Kim Baggett, who was awarded the Macquarie Medal Scholarship. She will talk about the work she is doing for that project and will then talk about her research into Bathurst history in general. But to put the Macquarie Medal in context, I talk with Mari Sullivan, who's devoted many years to studying Governor Macquarie and to celebrating his amazing achievements in the time he was Governor of New South Wales. Mari, you've always had Governor Macquarie as a great interest in your life, going back to well before 2010. Now, why would Bathurst have a scholarship or a medal in the name of Governor Macquarie?
Governor Macquarie founded Bathurst in May 1815. He commissioned the construction of the first road over the Blue Mountains by William Cox and his men. And that road, astonishingly, was completed in 6 months. And we're still rebuilding that road today, as we all notice as we drive out along the highway to Sydney. Governor and Mrs. Macquarie and their entourage had a viceregal progress out to Bathurst in 1815, and they founded it. At first, Bathurst was only allowed to be on the Kelso side of the river, and it wasn't until later when Governor Brisbane replaced Governor Macquarie after his 12 years tenure here that the British government allowed for settlers to spread further west.
When you say his entourage, how many people came over with him? Was it? I just imagine him coming over with him and his wife and a friend.
No, absolutely not. I think it was about 20 people. So there were accompanying convicts. There were people that, you know, had to look after the horses. They had to pack the coach and all the other carriages that came out, because Macquarie imported from India, because he was there in the military in a very senior roles for 20 years. He imported what were called Bengal tents, because, of course, very expensively, they cost £500, and he was criticised for that. But you imagine it. Imagine coming out to absolutely virgin bushland, at least. I know the land was settled by our First Nations people already, but he and Mrs. Macquarie couldn't just lay down a swag and sleep in the middle of the bush. There were no motels or hotels, and they couldn't stop off at Medlow Bath at the Hydro Majestic. So they came with a whole troop of people, and some of them were military people and some of them were surveyors and other interested people, but a lot of servants, of course, because they needed the extra people to cart all the stuff, their food. There was no McDonald's up on the corner.
They bring it all from Sydney.
They brought it all from Sydney. So it was all packed. The military and, you know, engineers within the military were extremely organised. They even brought their own china cups. So they had very neatly packed military, all in cedar, cabinets and things, and they just packed everything up beautifully and they brought everything across.
You said that the first settlement was on the Kelso side, but the flagstaff, which is the point, was on what I would call the Bathurst side.
Absolutely, it is. But Lee Steele, for example, has written a lovely little book that's down in Books Plus on the first 10 land grants, and they were all from the river pointing towards Kelso, just 50 acres each. But in those times, during Macquarie's time, only small allotments were allowable by the British government, and then later they enabled the first white settlers to have huge expanses of land, which we come to recognise as the sort of massive sheep and wheat spreads that we know today.
You were very involved in celebrating 200 years of Governor Macquarie. What was special about him? Why has he had such a legacy of special things?
We describe Lachlan Macquarie as a nation builder. When he arrived here, there were no indicia of what we call a civil society. Barely any churches, schools, roads, bridges. People weren't married. There weren't that many women here, because the convicts who came out under military supervision, they were predominantly men. So Macquarie made it his business to turn Australia, of course it was New Holland or New South Wales then, into the beginnings of what we know today. Unlike the earlier governors, who were all naval men and not used to operating on land as Macquarie was, he had a huge vision for a very urbanised and very civilised country.
Well, where did he get experience for that? I mean, he sounds like a town planner and a builder. Where did he learn those skills?
He was massively travelled. So, for example, after he spent his time in India, because the Napoleonic Wars were on, and he actually served in the Napoleonic Wars when he was taken from India by the British military over to Cairo, he could not travel back to England and he was due to go home on home leave. So marvellously and wonderfully, he went overland from India. So he went out through Iran and Iraq and through Russia, and he even carried diplomatic papers, etc., to Moscow, which are still in existence. There was an exhibition at Macquarie University named after him, of course, in about 2007, which was put together by the fantastic curator of the Macquarie Room at Macquarie University, Robin Walsh, of that tour to through Moscow and then out to Copenhagen. And then he came down from Denmark into England. So in his diaries, which are really extensive, you can read all of them on the Lachlan Elizabeth Macquarie archive, which has all been digitised by Macquarie University. You can just Google Lema, L-E-M-A, and it has all of Macquarie's, he was a great journal keeper, diary keeper, as was his wife. So all of his tours of duty throughout India, back to England via Iran and Iraq, as I mentioned, and out to Cairo, etc., they're all recorded in his diaries. In those diaries, he talks about how impressive he is with the beautiful town squares in places, for example, the beautiful parks, because in the 18th century, landscape became a really important facet of British design. So George III and the King was a huge agronomist and really interested in establishing massive parks like Hyde Park in London and St. James's Park. And of course, Moscow has massive central parks. We have our beautiful park in Bathurst, Macquarie Park. And all of that has followed on from the belief systems in the 18th century, which recognised that with industrialisation and everyone flocking to the cities, there needed to be green spaces.
Was he an educated man? Did he go to university? Well, where did he learn all this stuff?
He wasn't an educated man in that sense, no, because he joined the military when he was 14, and he was commissioned as a result of he had relatives who were very well off in Scotland. He was born on the island of Ulva, which is next to the Isle of Mull. Australians today flock, they did pre-COVID, they flocked to Mull because you can go to Mull to where his big estate was, Jarvis Field, and you can see his mausoleum in which he's buried his second wife, Elizabeth Macquarie, and their two deceased children. It's lovely to go there because people take little Australian flags, and it's co-looked after by the National Trust of Australia and the National Trust of Scotland. It's beautifully kept, and the Isle of Mull is very, very sparsely populated to this day. It's very remote. You have to go over by car ferry from the mainland at Oban over to Craignure, and it's a wonderful trip across.
When did he actually arrive in Australia? What date was that?
He arrived in Australia just before the 1st of January, 1810. And so he was sworn in as governor on the 1st of January. And that's how I came up with the concept of arranging the Macquarie 2010 bicentenary commemorations, because I said to myself, if I never have another original idea again, given that this is the 1st of January, I'm going to ensure that his life and times here and the contributions that he made to Australia, he even named Australia. He changed the name of Australia from New Holland to Australia itself in all of his writings and diplomatic correspondence back to England.
With all your studies, did you find that he must have been an approachable man, a man that got on with the people, got on with everybody?
He was and he wasn't. What he's renowned for is the Australian value of the fair go, because unlike other governors, particularly the ones that were ordered to change the system here after he left back to a system of terror and grotesque punishment, Macquarie took the view that if a convict served their time and they demonstrated merit thereafter, then they should be allowed to have a clean slate and start afresh. And for that reason, he was absolutely loved by the people who were called the emancipists, because they'd been emancipated from their convict trappings, basically. So there tended to be two types of people who came out as convicts. They were either 7-year sentences or they were life sentences. So most people were sent for the term of their natural life. And there's an interesting story attached to that, because in 18th and 19th century Britain, the Crimes Act mandated that about 380 what we would call extremely trivial offences, like stealing a sheep, a handkerchief or a roll of silk or whatever, they were deemed by the law at the time to be capital offences, hanging offences. So the judges are well recognised as having become soft, is the word that's used in the literature, because they couldn't bear to hang people for such trivial offences. So they substitute for that. They ordered long sentences or lifelong sentences to the colony of New South Wales.
So when he arrived in 1810, about how many people were in Sydney?
About 6,000. So there were quite a few because the white people had come out in 1788. So they were gradually expanding. And if you look, there are some beautiful watercolours and illustrations of Sydney at the time that he arrived. And by then, I mean, it's always sort of quite strange to think about. If you look at the area around the zoo and Mossman today, there's just absolutely stacked with trees and vegetation, very densely treed, the whole of Sydney was. So a lot of tree chopping had gone on by the time that Governor Macquarie got here. But one of the things on the tree topic is that all of the roads were just so rough, and this was one of his first orders, that you couldn't drive a coach down the main streets of Sydney's without breaking the axle on your coach, because whilst they'd chopped down the trees, they hadn't done what's called degrubbing, which is taking out the roots. So it was a terribly, terribly dangerous and rough ride to go from A to B. So that was one of his first instructions, to clean up the streets and just clean up the general urban squalor that he found when he arrived here.
It's not that long. I mean, they would have brought out horses and carriages. They certainly weren't any here. And food. There was not the same sort of food they had in England. They had to grow it, didn't they?
Growing food was a massive problem here because the coastal landscape around Sydney isn't particularly fertile. And you asked earlier why it was so important that Macquarie came out to Bathurst, and that was the main driver. There'd been droughts, as Australia is wont to have, and the production of wheat and oats and corn, etc., had failed. Most of the production went on around Richmond and Windsor and the very fertile Hawkesbury Plain there. But the whole reason for coming over the mountains was to expand the possibilities for growing crops and for raising and growing sheep and cattle for food for Sydney.
How long did he stay in Bathurst? And his wife came with him to Bathurst. How long did he stay here and who did he leave behind to take charge of?
Nobody really to start with. Later, William Lawson was put in charge, as Blackland, Wentworth and Lawson. And of course, the beautiful Macquarie property out on the O'Connell Road was William Lawson's land grant and the first beautiful homestead that was built out here. And if you have been to Macquarie to the opening, one of the beautiful buildings there, of course, is the convict barracks. And William Lawson had a few convicts that he'd been assigned. Most free settlers were assigned convicts to help them with all of the work at their properties.
The mind boggles, you know, having a whole lot of criminals helping out. I mean, he must have been a very good ruler to keep all the criminals in line.
Well, whilst they were lower socioeconomic, very poorly educated, a lot of these people, they weren't all like that. Plus, we have to get it into perspective because they weren't criminals in the sense of criminals that we talk about today. Most of them weren't murderers and drug addicts or bank robbers. Most of them were there for very, very trivial reasons. And I don't know if you've been to Port Arthur, but they have a wonderful system at the museum there, wherein you're given a card with the name of a convict on them and you follow their life. So if you're Monica Morse in 1788 and you've stolen a handkerchief and then you're transported for 9 long months in a filthy, dirty slave ship, the punishment didn't fit the crime. So lots and lots of people were far from what we describe as criminals today. So they were quite amenable. And of course, when they got here, once Macquarie started fixing the place up, that became a real problem for the British because people wanted to come here. They saw it as a sort of resort in the South Pacific. And when Macquarie was replaced by not so much Governor Brisbane, who was very benign, but Governor Darling, who had a lot of very horrendous habits and practices and really over-the-top punishments, Darling's brief was to stop the working class and the criminal class in Britain thinking that Australia was a resort in the South Pacific to which it was lovely to come to, which is what Macquarie kind of made it.
What's the nicest story you've learnt about him in all your studies? What's the one that you really enjoy hearing about and telling?
I think the really important thing about Macquarie is that he was very influenced by William Wilberforce, who, of course, was the key anti-slavery lobbyist in Britain. So Macquarie was extremely anxious to ensure that the convicts weren't treated as slaves. And the more well-off, and they're all military class, you've got to remember that it was an extremely class-driven system. Like, we're talking Jane Austen's time. So if you watch Pride and Prejudice was published in 1813, which was, you know, Macquarie was here in 1813, and society was really like as is depicted in Pride and Prejudice. So the military men, after they'd served their time, they all became the creme de la creme, white aristocracy, farmers and graziers. And they didn't want the convicts to be assigned to them as workers who were paid. They wanted them to be assigned as slaves. And Macquarie, very influenced by the works of William Wilberforce and the Quakers, and Macquarie wasn't a Quaker, but he would not have a bar of any human being in his charge being used as a slave.
Well, that's a lovely legacy, and it's been interesting talking to you about Macquarie, and it's a really nice legacy for Bathurst that we have people who are going to continue looking into history of all sorts, and that will keep going in memory of Governor Macquarie and Bathurst. So thank you. Mari thought the most appropriate music would be something that might have been performed at the time of Macquarie in Sydney. So here is some Schubert, the presto from his string quartet. Who knows, perhaps Mrs. Macquarie played this on her cello, which came to Bathurst in 2015. Kim, you're the recipient of the Macquarie Scholarship this year, and that's a research project. What are you researching?
My research at the moment is on the Theo Barker Archives, which were given to the Bathurst District Historical Society. And in my role there as an archivist, I discovered these archives, which I thought they underpin all the writings, all the academic work of Theo Barker's academic career from the late 60s right through to the current publication, which has been in Bathurst for the past 20 years.
He was at the university, wasn't he?
Yes, he started as an academic when it was Mitchell College of Advanced Education and the Teachers College. So he was there until, I think, approximately 1993-94. Most of the archives that are there span that time that he was there as teaching the current teachers or how to teach history. he was an educator that has influenced far beyond what he probably ever thought he would.
He was known for his studies of Bathurst. Did he have a wider interest?
He had an interest in military history. He had a publication on military history. Mm. He had publications within the Royal Australian Society, Historical Society's journals. He taught general history at what's now CSU. He had interests in the rugby in Bathurst. He had interests in St. Stanislaus College in Bathurst and helped with publications there. It's so much information that's contained in these archives.
What did you get? A whole lot of boxes and bits of paper?
Essentially. there's approximately 20 to 30 boxes of archives. I'm working my way at the moment through 11 of those boxes. I have interviews that were undertaken with 2BS, so I have an audio record of what he did. People, since winning this scholarship, have come forward with video of what he did and things like that. I have digital records of his later work. It's amazing what's contained within these archives. And since going through, I found slides, I've found photographic records that we weren't aware that were in these boxes.
I can remember when he died, people were saying we wish we could bottle his brain because of all that knowledge that's in there. But in fact, you've got it in these boxes, haven't you?
Yes. What he has left with his academic writings is a legacy that can be picked up, that can be built on, that can be expanded on, which is such a gift. The last book he wrote, the last two volumes of The History of Bathurst, all that research is contained within these archives.
What actually did he have in order to write the books?
It's all the primary research that he undertook. It's where he found all the little bits of information. It's all the drafts. It's all the little bits that he didn't put into the books that are there that now can be looked at with fresh eyes and expanded on. He's left a legacy that is far beyond what he probably thought. It's like a time capsule. I can open up a box and it's got all writings from 1980 and suddenly there's a 1969 file. Or there's information on headstones at the cemetery that may no longer be there, but there's a photograph. It's delving back into somebody else's research and looking at it with fresh eyes.
Well, this is the purpose of that scholarship, isn't it? That it enabled you to spend time on it, to work on it. How many days a week do you work on this?
At the moment, it's 2 days a week looking at it, and it's just a sorting exercise at the moment. It's very daunting when you find you've got 11 archive boxes of paper and you're trying to work out how you put them together. I've also got 14 folders and 2 boxes of card index, which you then have to sit down and cross-reference. And at some stage, somebody might have tried to write what that is, but you look at the cataloguing and it just says document or folder of documents. It doesn't tell you what those documents are and what they relate to. So it's a matter of sorting, and it can be tedious, but then you can find something like a box of slides and how do I find a slide projector to look at these slides? How do I get them digitised so we can see what they are?
What are you going to do with them all? Do you think of one box? There's a whole lot of bits and pieces in there. Do you sort them out as most important, not so important, or never mind about that?
No, I'm putting them into years, and then you look and see if there's a research project that went on in his life at that time. So it may be as simple as looking at a book or a document that was written at that time, and you may have all those notes, so you cross-reference it with the document. The final document may not be in the box. It may be published and, for example, on Bathurst Hospital. He wrote a small publication on Bathurst Hospital. So those notes can be in the box, but the publication isn't. The publication's at the Historical Society in a filing cabinet. So then you cross-reference it with that. And it's a process of putting a jigsaw together.
You must be extraordinarily patient. and methodical. I mean, the mind boggles at all these boxes. So you've got this one box and you put them, what, on a table? Do you lay them all out? Do you scan them? What do you do with them?
Eventually, I hope to have all of the records digitised. It will take a bit of time. And I can see this project probably going past the life of the Macquarie Heritage Medal Scholarship. I did not realise how big this archive was. There's also a large map drawer cabinet full of larger documents that he had. And anything else I find within the society that is related, such as speeches, further things that he wrote, there might be small articles and all those sorts of things. You end up having to cross-reference and pull together, and it takes longer, the life of the medals. In the end, this might be a 3 or 4 year project or even a 5 year project, but it's something that couldn't have been started without the medal.
The other thing that is encouraging is that Bathurst is going to have what we are calling the collections facility. So when you finish this in 5 years' time, you're going to have a place to put all this and a place where people can go and see it.
Yes, and that's so important, because the collection facility is a place where not is our culture, it's our heritage, it's what makes Bathurst us. And it's all going to be accessible in one place, which is really exciting. Instead of these small archives that are all around Australia that hold the most amazing collections, but in Bathurst we're going to have one place where we can all go.
When you got the boxes, was it the contents in good shape, or were the silverfish and stuff?
Yes, silverfish stuff, lots of dust. Yeah, you don't sort of dive into these boxes without expecting to be covered in dust and dirt and grit and grime. And it's just the nature of archives, especially when they've been placed in boxes and they haven't been opened for 20 years.
Did he put them in the boxes, or was that after he died?
I think it was after he died. I think some lovely people at the Historical Society put them into these boxes and tried to catalogue what was in them, and so we could go back at a later date. It's not unusual for me to open a box and there be some dead silverfish in the bottom, or a huntsman spider dead on the top of the box.
What's been the most exciting thing you found in these boxes?
I'd have to say the slides and the photographs that I didn't know that were there. And these are some microfiche that have come up from the State Library, personal photographs that are on slides, even acquiring the analogue cassette tapes that I'll transfer to digital. So everybody can actually hear his voice and what he was saying about Bathurst.
Did he have a family that taking an interest in your research?
He did. There were two sons. I would love to get in contact with them. I don't know whether they're still in Bathurst or they've moved away. Letting them know what I'm doing with their families or their father's research papers.
Well, there's something for the listeners. If you know whereabouts the two sons of Theo Barker have moved to or are living, please let to him so you know, because I know Kim would like to hear that. Go back to your exciting finds in your boxes.
There's a set of slides, yeah. And they're beautiful. They're coloured slides. I think they're from around the 70s, early 80s, and they're of monuments and headstones and all that sort of thing in Bathurst. You start trying to work out where they fit into what he was doing at that time, and everything is exciting. I mean, even the odd document that you open up and you read and you're trying to work out where the little card is to match it up. It's all exciting. It's kind of like prehistoric Googling. And you try to, you don't have the information in front of you. You've got to use a lot of detective work to try to piece it all together. Sometimes you're able to. Sometimes you've got to wait until you open up box number 10 to find the piece that was in box number 1.
Of course, there's the Theo Barker lecture, which we didn't have this year because of COVID. That's not just about Theo Barker, is it? It's a lecture in his name, but can be by other historians.
Yes, it's a memorial lecture that celebrates his legacy, which looks at other historians. The last one was on Let's Do Heritage Better, And that was interesting on how we can look and preserve our architectural heritage better. I think that's coming up this year. It was started, I think, about 20 years ago after his death, and it's every second year, yeah.
Mm. So what are you going to do with it all in the meantime? Will you put them back in the boxes?
No, I'll be writing what's called a collection management plan, which will see how the collection is managed. And it will be something that will be able to be used within the Historical Society as a template for any other collection that they bring in. And the documents will be scanned, so there will be a digital record. They will be placed in some sort of digital format that people can access. The paper archives will be cleaned and placed in a better way of storage. Everything's going to be catalogued, scanned, put into some sort of digital format. Even the analogue cassettes and the digital, I have about 30 or 40 discs, computer discs, that I will have to do the same thing with.
That's a problem because I have some old cardboard photographs going back to the 1870s. They're in perfect condition, but when I scanned them in some years ago and put them in a document for my children, I don't know what format they're in now and whether we can access them. So when you digitise things and you've got these tapes and discs, can you actually access them? A disc? Those big floppies they were called, weren't they?
They were 5 1/4 inch floppies, and I have about 20 to 30 of them from Theo Barker. And I've contacted last year, prior to the medal, Melbourne University, who did a similar project with the Germaine Greer archive, and they had exactly the same problem. And they've had to work out a way how to get the information off the 5 1/4 inch floppies and get it into another digital format that they can look at, print it off if possible, and then re-scan the document so they have a copy of it.
The technology of things is changing. For 10 years' time, it'll all change.
I think with COVID, they said that we've gone 20 years forward in technology than what we were expecting at this point in time, because we've had to adapt to it. In, for example, in 5 years' time, we may not have flash drives and we may not have the technology to actually read a flash drive. And to look at it, our mobile phone has more computing power than what it took to originally send man to the moon. That's how quick technology moves. So, yeah, I don't know whether in 10 or 15 years' time the work I do will be able to be accessed, which is why you need the paper records, why you need the indexing in paper. While it's great to have everything online and photos scanned and preserved, you need to keep the original documentation and everything. And that's how you mitigate, I suppose, having a 5 1/4 inch floppy from the 25 years ago that you now can't put into a computer.
Kim, I'm looking forward to hearing about the end of this whole project, but I hope that we can see it in the collections facility. I think that's going to be so important. Let's break off for some music and we'll talk about archiving and research in general, okay? Kim's interest in music is much more modern. She wanted to hear some Frank Sinatra, and here he is singing I'll Be Seeing You.
I'll be seeing you in all the old familiar places that this heart of mine embraces all day through. In that small cafe, the park across the way, the children's carousel, the chestnut trees, the wishing well. And I'll be seeing you in every lovely summer's day, in everything that's light and gay. I'll always think of you that way. I'll find you in the morning sun, and when the night is new, I'll be looking at the moon, I'll be seeing you. guess I'll be seeing you in every lovely summer's day, in everything that's light and gay. I'll always think of you that way. I will find you in the morning sun, and when the night is new, I'll be looking at the moon, but I'll be seeing you. Yes, I will dig you in the early bright, and when the night is new, I'll be looking at the moon. I'll be looking, but I'll be seeing you.
Kim, I have to ask about some of your other research and interests, and you and I share, I know, an interest in Mrs. Hawkins. Tell me about Mrs. Hawkins.
Oh, she was an incredible lady. She wrote these wonderful letters as she was coming over the Blue Mountains in 1822. Through my work at the Historical Society, we managed to find these letters that were actually donated in 1964 by a person called L.F. Hawkins.
I just question that. You said letters. I've only seen one letter. So she wrote more than one.
Yes, there is a set of them at the Historical Society. These letters came to light because I had an inquiry from the Hawkins family. A lovely gentleman was coming up and wanted to see what we had. So I made the appointment and I got everything out that we had. And these letters were held in a safe box. Literally, it had safe written on it. And they were letters that were donated by L.F. Hawkins in 1964, and they were held in the safe at No. 1 George Street, and no one had opened these boxes since they were placed in them in about 1981.
These were the real letters that she wrote, or were they something that somebody had copied?
These were actually the real letters that the family believed were lost in 1870. And the story that has been passed to me from the family is that the letters were sent back to England in 1870 to be serialized in one of the newspapers, and it was believed that the newspapers never handed them back. So when the family found that we had these originals, they were over the moon. So they were believed lost from about 1870.
She wrote a letter as if you and I were coming back from Sydney and we said, oh look, we stopped at a cafe and had coffee. They were very prosaic, very ordinary when she crossed the mountains, which must have been so scary in 1822.
Wouldn't have been comfortable. But the thing about letters, today we just shoot off an email and it's a brief thing, but letters, it's a voice. It's the most exciting voice. You are reading somebody's voice, somebody's story, and that's what these letters are. They're Mrs. Hawkins' voice.
Tell us about this, because she actually came across the mountain with a whole lot of babies and a mother-in-law.
Yes, and she settled in Bathurst. I've been reading the letters, but as the archivist, I don't know a lot about her. And these research projects give me the opportunity to learn. I mean, on the steepest learning curve you can possibly imagine, because when somebody asks, can you get us this information? Do you have this information? Do you have that information? I have to start thinking, where would the information be? And it is like what I call prehistoric Googling. Sometimes you don't have a point to start from. So with Mrs. Hawkins' letters, it was a lovely surprise to find them.
She wrote them to her sister, and she was coming to Bathurst. Her husband appointed as the storekeeper.
Yes, he was appointed as the storekeeper, and the store, from what I believe, was at Kelso, and it was the government stores. She came over with babies and the mother-in-law, and she was writing back to her sister about the trip, about what was going on at the time. These letters were believed lost, so she rewrote them from memory. And the most exciting thing about this is women aren't always portrayed or have their stories told in history. We hear about the generals and the lieutenants and all those sort of people. The women were just as important. So it's these letters give us an insight into the women of 1822.
What time of year was it? Was it cold?
From what I can gather from the letters, yes. Looking at the dates. Going through the Blue Mountains, it was cold, it was rugged, and you have to remember that Bathurst was settled in 1815, so this is only a few years after that.
The mind boggles, because I don't know how long it took, I don't know whether it was a week or not, but you could have a baby with nappies.
Yes. Imagine coming across, there were no proper roads, you're in a horse and buggy, you've got 9 children. That's probably every parent's worst nightmare.
And they must have brought their food. What did they have to eat?
Brought a certain amount of food, but they were the storekeepers, so they would have had when they got here. It's amazing just to think what we have now compared to what was back then.
How long did that first journey take? Was it a week or 10 days?
I think from the letters it was just over a week, but what is going to now have to happen with those letters is there's going to have to be a conservation process so we can read them, and that's where I come into it.
I say Mrs. Hawkins' letter. You've been saying letters. So there's more than one. I mean, did she write letters once she'd come to Bathurst and got started?
Yes. And they're held by the family, and we have a series of, when I say letters, there is a number of them, but there are a number of pages. That it is a small folder, and we have to remember when we transcribe these letters, because they're done in beautiful copperplate writing and using fountain pens and all that sort of thing, one page, maybe two lines when you type it.
On the other hand, I have a letter from my great aunt Agnes, which she wrote right across the page, and then she wrote it up and down. Is that the sort of thing that you found?
Yes, it find that with other letters as well. They'll write right across the page, and then you'll turn over, and it will say page 2, and then you turn back up the other way, and it's page 3, and then they've forgotten something, so they've put a line and put down here and an arrow, and they've written more. And when you transcribe those letters, you have to think, how do I put the letter back in order, because you are transcribing somebody's writings and they have to be transcribed exactly.
Where are the letters now?
They're at the Historical Society in Bathurst. They have been since 1964. Was just that the Society hasn't had an archivist for a while, and this request came through, so I started looking.
And this is just a request, what, from one of the family or from somebody in Orange?
A member of the family in Sydney who is writing a book, but it's not unusual to get higher academic requests. They are coming in quite regularly now. Other museums, the CSIRO is a recent one, people writing about pioneers in Bathurst. So we get a lot of requests through.
So many people interested in Bathurst history. There's a Facebook page called Bathurst Memories, and Dave Free puts on all sorts of things. And the number of people that look at that, there's thousands of followers of Bathurst Memories. So it's not just these sort of little people sitting in the cupboard looking at old things. It's people who are genuinely interested in the history of Bathurst.
Yes. I mean, the internet and Facebook has opened up so many avenues and so many opportunities to explore history. For example, during COVID, I ended up in lockdown. I could read and transcribe online Abraham Lincoln's letters in America because I could gain access to the Smithsonian Institute. That gives you an idea of the mind-boggling possibilities that could be done with history in Bathurst.
You mean to say you could see them as sort of a scanned copy of the letters in his handwriting?
Yes, you would get sent a scanned copy of a letter that hasn't been transcribed. You would sit there and type it and transcribe it, send it back and get credited for doing that. That's the kind of thing that I do at the Society. I will sit down and transcribe letters so that there is an access point for other people. A good example was I recently had an inquiry from a lady at Macquarie Uni who was writing a book on Mary Ann Piper, and she had the last page of a letter that she desperately needed the full letter to, and made contact with the Society. Because I had that little bit of the letter, I was able to find that sometime in the 1960s, we had access to the full letter, we had transcribed it. I was able to send her a copy of the transcription of an 1812 letter that Mary Ann Piper wrote to her brother in England that had come back.
I hear people talk about a thing called Trove. Tell me about Trove.
Trove is a database of newspaper articles, photographs, books. It's a very big database that is held with the National Library of Australia. Yes, you can find a lot on Trove, but you can't find the little letters. You can't find the odd photo that hasn't been scanned. Trove's wonderful. It's a wonderful starting point, but in order to do research, you take that starting point and you move beyond it. A little bit of information can take you a long way.
Going back to Mrs. Hawkins' letter, somebody rings up and said, could you tell me something about Mrs. Hawkins? Where do you start? Are the boxes with Mrs. Hawkins in it, or is it a filing system? Where do you start to find that or one from Mr. Smith?
We had a Hawkins box, but it didn't have Mrs. Hawkins' letters in it. So I literally opened up a cupboard, pulled out box number one, and started to go through it. For most of my research, I open up filing cabinet number one on the first drawer, and I start going through it file by file. We do have a card index, but over the years, it doesn't necessarily mean that the information on the card is going to be where it says. So you can use that as a guide, but in the end, you just open up a box, a filing cabinet, a cabinet, and start going through it.
What treasures do you find in these boxes?
All sorts of treasures. Colonial secretary letters, 1822 land grants, photographs, bank records, the shopping list of George Rankin's shopping list.
What was on that? What did he buy?
I think it was sheep and cattle it was all sorts of things. Sometimes it's just looking at the everyday. One letter that I absolutely love because I'm an artist is the curator's letter for the 1863-64 Chicago World Fair, asking for exhibits to be sent to Bathurst geological exhibits. You start to get a picture of how Bathurst started to fit within the world at the time.
To continue Mrs. Hawkins' career, I mean, she came to Bathurst and she had lots of children, didn't she? Well, she had a whole lot across the mountain. And they all survived. They were really fairly healthy lot.
You hear about lots of children and maybe four surviving. I know in my own family tree, there were 19 children, but not all of them survived. So you look at that and you think she was very lucky. And they were very lucky to come out here when it was, I'd say, I don't want to say primitive, but not what they're probably used to in England.
That was the final page of the letter when she said how blessed she was to come out to this wonderful country. And you think, oh my goodness, no laundries, no nothing. But probably in England, in London in those days, was awful.
Would have been awful in other ways. But out here, I think they were starting a new life. So they were blessed to have been doing that. And he was the storekeeper in. But you have to remember that period also was in drought in Bathurst. It was going into, so it was getting hotter and drier. It wasn't much different to what we had 12, 18 months ago.
That's interesting. Do you look up that sort of information, like the weather, when some of these events occurred, like Mrs. Hawkins, it's in drought? How did you know that?
Just from the descriptions of the vegetation and sort of knowing what was around and that sort of thing. And you could sort of tell by how people are describing the landscapes and the rivers and the grasses. You can sort of tell that it's either going into drought, hot weather, or what time of the year it is and that sort of thing.
Are there other people or other letters that you have found a bit later on in the history of Bathurst?
Oh, we have some wonderful, wonderful letters. I keep going on about it, but it's my favourite would be the Charles Darwin letter. The Charles Darwin letter.
You mean we in Bathurst have a letter from Charles Darwin?
Yes, it was written in 1863. It was sent from Bathurst to Penrith. And it's a lovely account of his stay along the Cox's River. So it's written 3 days after his stay at the Cox's River in Luerrawang. And it describes the geology of the Blue Mountains and the geology that there really wasn't anything really that interesting in the geology of Bathurst at the time. And this is 1836. So in 1836, we were actually in drought in Bathurst. So it's dry, it's January, it's hot. He's from England where it's cold, green. So he when people say that he wasn't favourable of Bathurst, it was stinking hot. There wasn't any water in the Macquarie River at the time. We were in drought. It was dusty. It was horrible. He was from England. He wasn't going to look favourably on it, to be blunt. But it describes the incident where he killed a platypus. To put that into perspective, yes, he killed the platypus, but he took it back to Cambridge University, where that platypus has been, want of a better word, stuffed, and it's on display. And that particular platypus incident was one of the most important contributions of Australia to the Origin of Species book. And we have a letter from Charles Darwin.
It's so exciting, isn't it? Because if you think about it, England is a bit like the Midsummer Murders program on television. You know, it's all green and lush and gorgeous beech forests and things. And to come out in Bathurst in the drought would have been awful.
It's so different and it's so bright. They're the bright greens, they're the yellows in England, where if you come out to Australia, it's the red ochres and the blues and the purples, I suppose the olive-type colours. Green in Australia is nothing compared to that, yeah.
And the trees are different. You know, the trees, we have a tree here in Piper Street, which looks like a tree, you know, with a trunk and a little sort of lollipop shape at the top. But gum trees are just all over the place.
Gum trees are messy. And the Australian, for want of a better word, the Australian natural environment and the bush and that is messy. But having that letter from Charles Darwin was the reason why I did science. I read The Origin of Species at school. It was the reason I ended up doing environmental science. And then I have transcribed a letter from Charles Darwin. That transcription has been sent down to Cambridge University. Cambridge University had a copy of the letter that was sent down as a photograph in the 1980s, early 80s, and I've worked with them to confirm not only that we have the letter, but the transcription of the letter. So that's another wonderful job I got to do.
Just remind me, the letter itself, the original one with his, where is that?
That's at the Historical Society.
I mean, I thought I knew a bit about Bathurst history, but that is a real revelation that we don't promote that very well. We talk about, you know, Governor Macquarie coming over and putting up a flagpole, but the Charles Darwin letter is not a big feature of Bathurst's pride.
No, and I think it should be. It was the 175th anniversary of the Origin of Species publication a few months ago, and I think they looked at that, and in Australia, the Bureau of Statistics said that it has influenced 80,000 people to take up careers in scientific and natural history. That one, and that was the Beagle expedition, where he went back to England and he wrote the most definitive book on natural history and genetics.
Tell me, why don't we, as ordinary Bathurst people, have the opportunity to see that letter? Why isn't it somewhere where we can go and look at it? And same with Mrs. Hawkins, why can't we see it? Obviously behind glass, because it's so precious, but I've never seen it.
I don't think it's widely. We hear about Governor Macquarie, we hear about coming over the mountains and surveying Bathurst. But no, when I found out this was, I wanted to shout it from the rooftops. It's an incredible letter. We have letters from Queen Vic, referring to Queen Victoria and from Queen Victoria. We have what you would call internationally significant items, such as the Charles Darwin letter. We have nationally significant items. Significant items just to Bathurst.
I think you and I should plan some plans. I mean, it's difficult with COVID, but we have Heritage Week every year. We have Proclamation Day. But this has sort of slipped by everybody. I think it's amazing, and you've done some fabulous work. And I think you and I could spend the whole morning chatting about all the things you've done. And I certainly want to hear more that you've done about Ben Chifley, because you've been an expert on Ben Chifley. I thank you very much for today's interviews, and I look forward to doing more. Thank you.
Thank you.
The more we hear about Bathurst history, the more fascinating it is. It's amazing that documents from so long ago have been kept and are in good condition. I'll leave you to Kim's other choice of music. She likes James Galway on flute, and here he is playing the Peer Gynt Suite No. 1.